Work shouldn't feel like a drag, and you shouldn't have to sacrifice your soul for a job you love. Determined to rethink the future of work, she's out of her depth on purpose. With fresh ideas, interviews, and stories from her life on the road, meet Europe's newest digital nomad, Blair Palmer.
Hello and welcome to episode 85 of A Brilliant Gamble. I hope you are really well. We are still in Italy. We're really settling into it now. We're enjoying our life here. It was my birthday yesterday, and so we did some touristy stuff. We did roller coasters and we dived with dolphins, which was really fun, swam with the dolphins, and lots of water slides and that kind of thing. So we had a sort of holiday day yesterday. But to be honest, in this kind of country where it's pretty hot and where you're by the beach, it's very hard not to spend quite a lot of time paddling around in the water. So most days it feels like at least for a few hours we're on holiday, which is absolutely lovely. That's definitely something I was seeking from this trip. So that's all going really well. And we've got some really great interviews lined up for you over the next few weeks. Really excited about what we're going to be bringing you. It's fantastic to talk to the people that we're having on the show. I'm finding them so inspirational, and I hope you are too. Which brings me to today's guest. Now, how many people say that they want to write or paint or draw or craft as their full-time living? How many of us have at some point imagined ourselves devoting our lives to creative pursuits that bring us fulfillment and allow us to express ourselves, rather than this idea that we should be more practical and do, in inverted commas, a proper job? Well, today's guest tells us how he made that a reality. Tom McLaughlin is a hugely successful author and illustrator. His books include The Accidental Prime Minister, The Story Machine, and the Captain Buckaboots series. He's never really had a proper job, although he hasn't always been a full-time writer. And in this interview, we talk about his story, discovering that he was dyslexic at school and how that's affected his professional choices, how he deals with work-life balance when it's gone wrong and when it goes right, the creative process, and what he's learned about turning the activity you love into a job you love. So without further ado, let's go over to the interview. Tom, so good to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm really good. How are you?
Yeah, really well. Thank you. I'm so excited to have you on because you're like a big time star now.
I wouldn't go that far. I'm doing all right for an author and an illustrationist. I believe that's the correct term. Yes, I'm doing all right.
Well, look, I mean, how does it feel when the lovely Tom Hardy is asked to read one of your books on CBeebies? How is that moment?
Yeah. It's pretty good. I get asked about that quite a lot from ladies. Only from ladies, isn't that strange? It's really nice. It was really nice. It was a lovely surprise. Whenever you write a book, there's always this sort of possibility that they get read on TV. And I've had a couple of them broadcast on the sort of CBeebies bedtime story thing. So it's been really nice. I had Simon Pegg once, which was lovely. And so yes, when it came up, I knew it was going to be read. Didn't know who it was going to be read by. It could be sort of, you know, anyone. It could be someone from Hollyoaks, some sort of sports presenter. And then I got told, and I wasn't allowed to tell anyone. It was going to be embargoed. It's going to be a sort of big press release thing, because it was just before Valentine's Day, so it was going to be read on Valentine's Day. So it's almost like the BBC knew what they were doing. And yeah, it was really good. And then it sort of went all over the internet. It was all over the papers, all over, you know, sort of like news sites in America that Tom Hardy apparently broke the internet. I'm not sure what that means, but yeah, it was really nice, really nice. I think we might have even sold a couple of books after it as well, which is always helpful, always pleases the publisher.
Well, we'll come to selling books in a minute, because I mean, it's no easy thing to do, and so many people want to write. I mean, when we talk about, you know, creating the life that you really want and doing something that really is an expression of who you are, doing something creative is very often what people are driven towards doing, but actually making a living out of it is well, I was going to say it's almost impossible, but of course it isn't. People are doing it and you're doing it. So, how did that come about? How did you become a full-time working writer?
Yeah, it's sort of odd. It's one of those things, when you tell people you're a writer, they either assume you're incredibly rich or that you must have a proper job as well. You know, you're either doing incredibly well or you're kind of starving in a garret somewhere, you know, trying to make ends meet. For me, it started out, well, it was a bit of a sort of scenic route. I started out as an illustrator first. I wasn't particularly, I guess, academic at school. I was the kid at the back who was always staring out the window, daydreaming. Really bad at sort of reading and writing. I was kind of, you know, on the blue table. When I was at school, everyone was kind of separated into tables. I was on the blue table with the kids who stuck crayons in their ears and things like that. And so it was my mum. It turned out it was quite coincidental. My mum had just had my sister, and she's a teacher. She was on maternity leave, but trying to get into some work. And she started working for this centre to help kids with dyslexia. It was a fairly new thing, sort of back in the late 80s. It was a kind of the new invention. And she was really interested in it and started working with all these kids and started learning more about kids with dyslexia, and sort of started ticking a few boxes for her. And then it was kind of, maybe Tom's dyslexic, because, you know, I was getting the sort of doesn't concentrate at school, lazy, doesn't try, all these kind of things in my sort of school reports. So I got tested, and it turned out I had dyslexia. So yeah, I was sort of, brilliant, great, what happens now? What's the cure? Pass me the tablets. I want to be clever. And it just didn't happen. I was still the kind of kid at the back who was still considered lazy and daydreaming. And so I sort of, you know, started to draw and got better and better at it, and sort of had that kind of moment where, actually, I've got a talent. I think it's really important for kids to find their talent, and whether that's sort of drawing, whether it's English or maths, whether it's, you know, just being the funny kid at school, or the kid who's really good at skateboarding or something, whatever it is your talent is. Mine was drawing, and it was just, right, I'm going to be the best drawer in my class. I'm going to be the best drawer in the school. And so my drawings have always been kind of, rather than just something pictorial, they've always been, you know, an idea in the drawing. And that's sort of how I got into writing, these kind of drawings with ideas.
And you didn't go straight into creating books. You had a sort of, in a sense, a proper job. You were a cartoonist, a political satirist for a while.
It was good. I went to art college in Falmouth. I did illustration, and everyone was sort of either drawing kind of cutesy kittens or drawing, there was a lot of kind of like men on horseback with axes and small trolls and things like this. And I was just massively, as a bit of a sort of political nerd, I used to love sort of politics. I used to love satire, Spitting Image, Have I Got News For You. That was sort of the thing I really, really loved when I was a teenager. And I just, all I wanted to do was kind of work for Spitting Image. I wanted to sort of do the impressions. I can't actually do impressions. So I thought, okay, I can't do that, but I can be a caricaturist. And so I sort of taught myself how to be a caricaturist. The thing about caricature, it's such a weird thing. You're taking someone's face and you're sort of making everything out of proportion, yet it still has to look exactly like them. It makes no sense when you think about it. And so everyone else was sort of drawing their own thing, and I was doing caricatures. And it just so happened that the Western Morning News, which was a big regional daily newspaper down in the southwest, Devon and Cornwall, were looking to relaunch in a tabloid form. They were looking for a cartoonist, and someone suggested try the sort of local art colleges. And I was the only person who was doing that stuff. And so I sort of, yeah, at the age of 20, I got a job straight out of art college, where I was sort of having to sit around watching the news, come up with jokes, try and sort of caricature the sort of politicians of the time. It was about the time when sort of Tony Blair swept power. So it's quite an interesting time in politics anyway. It was a really hard job for a kind of 20-year-old to get their head around. I think you've got to be fairly sort of worldly wise when it comes to politics. So I'm not sure it was necessarily right for me at the time. But yeah, all what I was doing was drawing pictures and I was writing jokes or writing words. And that's, you know, effectively what I do now. Just I draw more pictures and write more words.
What's really interesting to me is that you never really went into a sort of conventional line of work. You know, you had this idea from very early on that you could do something that was based around your talents and an artistic talent in particular. And did no one, this might sound like an odd question, but did no one try to put you off?
Yes, they did. I guess there's a part of me that's sort of making up for lost time, and I always feel like I'm making up for lost time, even though I sort of started, found my talent when it was probably about sort of 13, 14, started to really get into drawing, but it felt like I was, you know, the gun had gone off in life and I was sort of doing nothing for the first 10 seconds. And then, so there was always an enormous amount of catching up and, right, and this is my thing, I'm just going to be bloody minded and be the best I can be. People sort of said when I was going to do illustration at college, people were kind of trying to steer me down the graphic design route because, you know, that's more job opportunities down there. But I didn't want to do it. I just wanted to keep drawing. And there were times once, you know, I got made redundant from the newspaper after about 10 years because the sort of bottom and money fell out of regional newspapers and still continuing to fall. And they, you know, a cartoonist was considered a luxury when you're having to sort of let reporters and sub-editors go. So there was times, you know, the lean years between sort of leaving the paper and getting a publishing deal, very sort of lean years, but I'm just going to keep going because I think it felt like I sort of invested everything. I'd been doing this for like 10 years, 10 plus years. It felt like to sort of give up and try something else felt like it'd be an enormous sort of waste of all those years and all that time that I'd spent sort of trying to get where I'm getting. So it's kind of, no, I'm going to keep on going. And luckily it sort of worked.
Yes, it has worked. And I want to come back to why you think it's worked in a minute. But one of the things that I'm curious about is, you know, most of the time we think that the most sensible thing to do is to have something to fall back on. So, maybe someone has an idea for a novel or they paint and they want to make that into their living, but they have this other thing that they can fall back on. And that always sounds very sensible, but I do wonder whether when you have something else to fall back on, you do. And at once, in your case, you didn't, I mean, you could have got a job, I'm sure, but you didn't particularly have anything to fall back on. So you had to make it work?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, in my head, it was kind of like, I'm not really qualified to do anything else. You look in the newspapers, there doesn't tend to be sort of many jobs for a sort of ex-satirical cartoonist. Or I think there is that element of, if you don't take the leap, if you don't kind of jump off the cliff and kind of go for it, then you can always have that thing that can stop you from really, really trying or pushing yourself. That's not to say that, you know, I haven't had sort of support from partners and during those kind of lean years where it's allowed me to sort of go upstairs and draw and work and send stuff out and get rejection letters and things like that and still pay the bills and things like that. So that's been, you know, incredibly valuable. But I do think there is something to be said for that kind of just being comfortable enough with, you know, between two worlds. Sometimes you've got to make yourself a little bit uncomfortable in your kind of sink or swim moments, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me about those lean years. That's the point at which I think a lot of people would say, well, this isn't working.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to the point where you thought, look, maybe this isn't going to happen? Or did you just, I'm just wondering if that, for someone who actually makes it in the end, whether they just don't think that, they just carry on regardless.
There was a bit, there was a lot of that, I think, you know, there were times where it was, I don't think this is going to happen. I got, I was sending out stuff to a lot of kind of publishers, having sort of made the sort of leaving the newspaper and coming to the conclusion, right, okay, I can either try and get back into newspapers or I can try and do something different. I can try and start to write, maybe think about animation, think about children's illustration, sort of, you know, make up my own world or kind of illustrate the existing real world. And there was sort of times where, you know, you're sending stuff out and you're getting those kind of rejections that you sort of think, is this going to happen? Am I just sort of paying my dues or am I kind of basically making a bit of an idiot of myself? And, you know, I would get nice letters back saying, this is great, we'll keep stuff on file. What sort of changed for me was eventually sort of a couple of animation things almost sort of coming to fruition and me needing an agent and then having that sort of professional person who can sort of open doors, who can pick up the phone and sort of say, can this guy come and show you his illustrations? That was the sort of the breakthrough moment, getting an agent. But, you know, I also got turned down by quite a few agents as well. So it was, you know, eventually I think you sort of, if you imagine like 10 people starting a race and for every rejection letter, maybe a couple drop out and then, okay, so there's now sort of 8 people in the race and then another, you get to the next stage, more rejection letters, another couple of people go, this isn't for me. I think eventually you have to kind of think someone's going to give me a job just to stop me bothering them and emailing them and phoning them up. So maybe that was me. I don't know.
That's a really interesting idea because I know that I've won business in the past because, you know, I will have been introduced to a client and they were looking at the time for someone to come in and do what I do. And they will have been talking to 4 or 5 different suppliers as well as me. And then they decided not to proceed. And one by one, all the other 4 just lost touch with them, but I stayed in touch even when there was no business to be had. And 3 years later, when they eventually decided to do the thing, I was the only one still around. And I wondered something about that, the persistence and the kind of other people fall by the wayside.
Yeah, I think there is. And I think, you know, you've got to show that you're reliable and nicely mannered and sort of a person who isn't weird on the phone or anything like that. You basically sort of got to be normal without sounding desperate. And just kind of keep putting yourself out there or go, you know, okay, so it was a rejection from you last year, but I'm in town seeing a few other people, which may or may not be true. I'd love to drop in and show you some more illustrations. I've been working on some new stuff, some different stuff. And, you know, if you're nice and polite and you had a nice time last time, then they're going to go, okay, that'd be great. Come in and see us. We'll have a coffee for 20 minutes and just keep on doing that. That's you know, sort of how I did it. Maybe it was just, the thought of I can't do anything else. So maybe I was, you know, screaming and crying and desperate underneath, but outwardly you've got to be sort of fairly professional. I think particularly in sort of these creative and sort of artistic careers, you can't be sort of like the wild artist who sort of turns up and screams and shouts and can't be contacted for, you know, you've got to be a professional as well as be creative. You know, the two aren't mutually exclusive.
Yeah, which brings me to the way you work, because I know that you there was a time when you had the work-life balance thing pretty wrong, but you found a way now to actually work in a way that many of us are trying to get away from, a kind of 9-to-5 sort of work pattern. So tell me about when it went wrong and how you fixed it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is the sort of that kind of workaholic thing that I have, you know, it sounds, I think people don't expect it with creative side of in the kind of creative world. People tend to think of it as sort of like banking or stocks and shares, where you have this kind of drive and this creative stuff. But so many people who write as illustrators are incredibly kind of competitive. And so there is that sort of work is more fun than fun type attitude. And for a long time, I was sort of, right, I've got my foot in the door. I can't let this go. It was, you know, working 10 hours, 6-7 days a week, possibly, you know, just really any spare time while having sort of two young boys was incredibly difficult. But it was that kind of thing, I've got this far, I can't let this go. And part of that has changed now, partly because I think I'm sort of better at what I do and I'm quicker at what I do. So I'm sort of still working probably producing more, but working less in order to do it. But yeah, it took a real toll on me, those kind of early few years. And I, you know, it was with my ex-wife, and we're no longer together. Whether that was a sort of catalyst for that, I don't know. But I'm sure it didn't help. And sort of, yeah, trying to get that balance right and trying to kind of go, well, I need a career, I need to earn, I need to sort of put myself out there so I can look after my family, while also, you know, shutting yourself away in the kind of room upstairs while your family sort of exist and grow up around you. It's a really difficult kind of thing, you know, you're torn. It's really hard, I think, working at home, because you're sort of basically living in the office, aren't you, or bringing your family to the office. It's never quite as simple as I'm just going off to shut myself away, I'll go and do a day's work, because you're never quite at the office and you're never quite away from home. I've sort of, things have changed for me now in the sense that I go to a place in town in Exeter called The Generator, which is a sort of co-working space, which is full of other freelancers. So you get that, I'm off to work, leave everything at home, go and do your work and then come home and sort of do family stuff, which is really, really sort of important. You also get the community of going to an office and the sort of social aspect of that, which again, I think is a really important part of surviving. I remember working when I was working from home and sort of trying to sort of forge a career. I would, you know, you'd go to Tesco's just in order to be able to speak to someone. It's a little bleak insight into my life. But now, you know, having just sort of thinking about work being more professional and the kind of a place where I can go and work. You know, there's a lot of sort of people who work around coffee shops and things like that, which is a sort of nice way of doing it. Also, the technology's changed as well. You know, I used to have a huge, giant iMac scanner, drawing board, pens, ink, paper. Now, I've got an iPad Pro, which allows me to fit my entire studio into my bag. And, you know, I can do all my writing on there. I can do all my illustration on there as well. And, you know, you would never tell the difference that it's done purely digitally. I was kind of very, very worried about making the leap from kind of pen and paper and actually drawing stuff on the screen. But it looks really nice. No one knows the difference. You can email it from wherever you go. And if you get stuck in the snow, like I did last year on World Book Day in Bristol, going around schools, it means that if I'm hauled up in a hotel, I can sort of get on with some work and stuff like that. So, which makes it, you know, makes me more efficient. So I think I've got the balance right now. I'm fairly 9-to-5, and then means when I do come home, I can turn everything off and just sort of be with the kids, you know, be the dad that I sort of wasn't quite able to be the sort of first time round.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm experimenting a lot at the moment with different ways of working and different places and just different formats. And there is this, you know, when I worked at the BBC, I used to love, if we were interviewing an author on the show in a few days' time, then whoever was in charge of that interview would have the day at home to read the novel and to do the research.
Yeah.
Would read the novel in the office, and I used to love if that was ever me, and I would spend the day at home and I would read the novel and think, this is amazing. But that stayed with me when I had this idea, well, I could work at home full time. But the reality is kind of what you say, which is it's very difficult. It doesn't work for everybody. because it's very difficult to make that distinction between when I'm working and when I'm not. Easier to procrastinate. I mean, it's quite easy to procrastinate in a corporate environment because you can be busy doing a lot of stuff that doesn't make any difference. But, you know, it's easier to be distracted and no one can see you being distracted when you're at home. Do you find that having a place to go, because the co-working spaces are just, you know, really on the up now, really growing, do you find that having a place to go prevents procrastination or writer's block or any of that, or does that still happen?
It's still, I mean, procrastination, I think, is part of the process. So I don't look at it as kind of time wasted. I remember sort of Armando Iannucci talking about this, who sort of was the writer of Alan Partridge and Veep and Death of Stalin and stuff like that. He said, you know, what they would do is they would sit in a room before the writing and sort of knock around ideas. And then, you know, a few days they were flicking elastic bands around. And it's part of the process to get ready for work. It's, you know, it's kind of getting rid of the extra energy in your brain in order for you to concentrate. So the procrastination and the staring out of the window is part of the creative process. So I don't particularly worry about that. In terms of writer's block, it's not something that I wouldn't say I've never had, but each book is different. And so sometimes the idea for a book lands complete and it's neat and it's a circle idea. I call them kind of circle ideas where the narrative, rather than it being linear, starts at one place and goes around and knits together at the end of the circle. And it's a beautiful kind of idea within itself. Some ideas you have a kind of start off with a drawing or a title, and you're almost writing the book from the middle outwards. So everything is different. What's hard is that the machine that I do all my work on is also the machine that allows me to access everything else in the world: my emails, my text messages, social media. So sometimes you have to kind of just, you know, switch it off. But there is no greater motivation than, if I don't get this done, then I'm not going to get paid. And if I don't get this done, then it means that the next project I'm starting next week, everything's going to be delayed. So ultimately, I don't worry about sort of hitting those deadlines or procrastination, because I know that it always gets done. If you have 2 weeks to do and something that takes you 2 days, you're always going to do it on the last 2 days of those 2 weeks. You know, you're gonna mess around on YouTube and flick elastic the first week, and then you'll get it done, because that's just the way it is. But yeah.
So for those people who are who have an idea, and I know we have people listening who they may want to have more creativity or more of a creative outlet as well as their job. That for them is a really good blend. And for a lot of people, actually, they're thinking, you know, could I really turn this idea I have into a novel, into a piece of art? Could I make money from my creativity? I mean, in a way, it's kind of a cliche question, but where do they start? Do they need to have everything set up? Do they need to have a separate working space? Do they need to have all the technology? Do they need to have tons of time? Or is it possible to do it in a more haphazard way?
I think it is. It completely is. If it's a good idea in terms of, if it's a good story that, and you're really happy with the idea, then you will write it. If there's something not quite right with the story, then you'll sort of find reasons not to get it done. It's the same with drawing as well. If it's a good drawing, then you will find the time. That could be in a co-working space, that could be at home, it could be in a coffee shop, it could be anywhere you like, really. It's I guess a true sort of test of whether what you're making is good. You know, I think it's hugely important that sort of this creative side, and I go around and talk to kids about this all the time, about how we need to draw. And I talk to teachers, sadly, who sort of, you know, they're so busy with kind of targets and league tables and things like that, that kids actually don't get to sort of sit around and be bored and draw, which is such an important part of the creative process, but also that sort of need to sort of nourish the soul that you get from reading a book, from writing something, for drawing something. So, you know, the kind of this creativity that we sort of, that we want as part of our life is, you know, it's because we're kind of humans and we crave art and we sort of need this. It sort of makes life worthwhile. I don't know in terms of sort of if it's a good idea, you will find the space. I don't think you need to kind of go, right, I need a writing shed at the bottom of the garden. I need, these are my hours. You know, start off small. Don't have grand plans would be my sort of way of getting into it. You don't need, I use an iPad. I was talking about it before, which is great for me, but you don't need that. That's not going to make your drawing better. It's a blank piece of paper, whether it's a blank piece of paper on a screen or it's a blank piece of paper in kind of on, you can touch and feel. That's the most important thing. There is sort of practical stuff you can do in terms of writing, just like planning where the story is, planning how you're going to get from A to B, a little kind of roadmap of your idea, little sort of chapter notes. This is chapter one, we're starting here, this is where we're going to end up, and sort of spacing and pacing things out is a sort of really good way. You get a kind of bird's eye view of your story then, and then you can sort of expand and things like that. And that's a sort of practical sense in terms of getting on with writing. I don't, you know, setting yourself up with social media is always a great way of sharing stuff. In terms of illustration, in terms of blogs and things like that, you know. But I guess the most important thing is not necessarily to think about the wider audience, is to do stuff that you would want to read, do stuff that you would want to see. I don't know if that's any use, but that's sort of the way I would go about it.
Yeah, and it reminds me, I used to coach a very well-known author, and he was struggling with, he'd written a couple of really successful books, and he was struggling with the next idea because his audience were on the edge of their seats waiting for his next book. He didn't want to let them down.
Yeah.
And I really like what you're saying about just trying as far as possible to shut those voices away and to write what you want to write and not try to appeal to an audience.
Yeah. This is what I'm not particularly well read, so when I read stuff, I don't tend to read other children's books. I don't tend to see what is out there. I don't tend to read fiction. I'm big sort of non-fiction stuff, so all the kind of comes back to the politics again. I'm kind of all over the political novels of, you know, sort of Fire and Fury, and I'm a big fan of sort of John Ronson and these kind of people. So I'm not sort of one who kind of dips their toe into the sort of stuff that I write. It can be a little bit too distracting. Sometimes, for instance, if I'm kind of thinking about illustration and drawing, I'm kind of going, I'm not quite sure how to do this, so I'll go on Pinterest. And it's one of those things that I can go on Pinterest for like maybe 5 minutes and then I have to turn it off, because suddenly you're surrounded by 1,000 different drawings and you've suddenly lost your own voice, and you've kind of lost the drawing that you wanted to draw, and you're kind of so influenced by everything else that it can be really overwhelming. And I think it's the same with sorry to my wife, and she was thinking about sort of getting a blog going, and she was sort of looking at so many different blogs, and suddenly the kind of, well, should I write it like this? Should I write it like that? And you kind of know you need to sort of write it for how you want to write it, that kind of vision that you want to do. It's whether it's writing or illustration, it's, you know, how is this going to be? Okay, it might not be as great as the illustrations on Pinterest, but this is the illustration I want to make. And I think you can be, it's really easy to be swayed by so many different kind of voices or so many different influences. So I don't tend to, if I'm about to start a new book, I don't look at other people's books. It's not sort of what I'm interested in. I'm too busy to sort of trying to get my story right.
That's so important, I think. I love the fact that you say you don't read much.
I don't. It's because, you know, it's, I listen to a lot of audiobooks and listen to a lot of podcasts, but reading for me is such, that's the kind of, in terms of dyslexia, the most it affects me. My spelling is not great, but it's one of those things that can be fixed. The hardest thing for me is reading. When I have a new book out, I tend to have to go around to schools and read it in front of kids. And I basically have to learn, relearn the book that I'm reading. Whether, even if it's a picture book, which has got really simple words in, really simple words that I wrote, it's such a kind of stressful thing for me. I even actually, it's a true story. I once got, when my first chapter book came out, it got turned into an audio book, and they sort of offered me the chance to read it. I thought, I'd take my son. This will be a really sort of proud father-son moment. We'll go and see me reading my first ever audiobook. The time was sort of like the moment I felt I'd gone from an illustrator who writes a bit to a proper writer. I just couldn't read my own book. I got fired from my own audiobook. we hid in a KFC for the afternoon and sort of just ate loads of chicken and sort of just, it was such a bleak moment. But yeah, sort of in terms of reading, it's sort of one of the things I really, really struggle with. So I think this is true with a lot of dyslexic people who you've grown up as dyslexic. I don't think they're particularly well read in terms of, they're not particularly articulate, or they don't get their articulate nature from books. They get it from sort of verbal dexterity, because they kind of learn to be quick-witted. And I think that's so where I got mine from. I got my, you know, all my sort of my words from Blackadder and Monty Python and podcasts and those sort of stuff.
It's really interesting. I mean, I'm not a expert in dyslexia at all, but I do read quite a lot about it because I homeschool, and so I need to understand, you know, quite a lot about education and different ways of accessing information, different ways of growing your brain. And I've read some really interesting stuff that says, in a sense, there isn't such a thing as dyslexia, that there are just different ways of seeing the world and different ways of learning and different ways of absorbing information. And some of us will find one way of absorbing information fits us better than another way. And so in actual fact, being dyslexic in a sense could be perceived as a huge advantage in some way, because it shuts down a certain way of learning and then opens up all these other opportunities.
Absolutely. I was talking to Sally Gardner. I did a couple of years ago, Sally Gardner, the dyslexic writer who wrote Maggot Moon. We sort of did something at Bloomsbury where we sort of talked about kind of how it affects us and things like that. It was really empowering, actually, because we had a load of kids who were also dyslexic, who'd been brought by their parents. And it was, yeah, there was high-fiving, there was fist-bumping at the end. It was great. She was talking about sort of how MI6 was sort of actively recruiting people with dyslexia because they're great at sort of solving problems. I talk to kids all the time about this and sort of say it's a superpower. I know a lot of publishing designers use, not specifically, but it turns out that a lot of designers in the publishing world are dyslexic, because if a dyslexic can make something work for them and easily readable for them, then it means that, you know, the rest of the world's not going to have a problem with it at all. So I always think of it as a superpower, and I don't know whether it's helped me creatively, because I don't know what it's like to be not like this. In terms of sort of whether it exists or not, I know from my experience that having sort of being surrounded by words every day, all day, I still can't read any better than I could when I was, you know, sort of about 10 years old. So that's never changed, and that's never going to change. And, you know, that's something that I've kind of had to kind of cope with and learn how to deal with, you know, when a new book comes out, it's right, I've got to put in the groundwork. I've really got to read this and read this and read this.
One of the other things I've read about you is that you don't see a blank sheet of paper as intimidating. I know a lot of people, when they're about to start writing, they're poised, you know, they're beautiful new books that they just wrote for the purpose, or in front of their laptop and their fingers are all ready and the blank sheet of paper is staring back at them, and it's terrifying. But you don't see it like that.
No, yeah, I think we've all been there, haven't we? We've got right. We've chosen the font. The spacing is just right. I've got my cup of coffee. I'm ready to go. Effectively, sort of the last thing you should be doing, I think, is you should be at that stage. Is kind of poised at the laptop. Kind of all the hard work and all the sort of stuff should be done beforehand. When you've got sort of, you need a direction. I think you need a place to go. Here's where I'm going to start. Here's where I'm going to finish. A blank piece of paper. You know, it's a fantastic thing because it means that this little doodle, this little kind of half idea that I made a note on my phone, sort of walking past, looking at the clouds. That's an interesting thing. I wonder if that could be a drawing. Is that a drawing or is that a story? Maybe it's both. Maybe if I start the drawing, see what happens, it might turn into a story. That's the sort of way kind of it works for me. So yeah, I always talk to kids, particularly about drawing, about how sort of there is no such thing as a right or wrong when it comes to art. You know, it's just about having fun and seeing where it takes you. There's no one there to sort of judge you particularly, you know. So many kids sort of say to me, I'm going to write a book. My son did this. I'm going to write a book. He said, oh, that's really good, Harry. What? Yeah, it's going to have 100 chapters in. Oh, right. Okay. Is it really? Just don't start with that. You know, start with something small. One of the sort of ways that I got into writing, sort of having felt very kind of scared and nervous about working with words and trying to write a story is using poetry. There was a great book called The Melancholy Death of Oyster Boy by Tim Burton, the Tim Burton. He sort of wrote these kind of crazy poems, sort of weird drawings. But sort of, I love that book. And I really recommend this. Poetry is a great way, whether it's like for adults to start writing or for kids to start writing, because it gives you a natural structure. So the first line has to rhyme with the third line, the second line rhymes with the fourth. So you have a kind of framework to work within. So the blank piece of paper then is feeling less big and less huge and less scary. It's sort of building those foundations. And the great thing about poetry is it can be a joke, it can be a story, it can be an idea, it doesn't have to make sense, but it's a way of sort of dipping your toe in.
Yeah, I've always thought that, you know, everyone used to say, they don't say it anymore now because it's such a cliche, but, you know, let's think outside the box, let's think out, you know, outside the envelope. And I always thought, actually, let's try and think within it, because the completely blue sky, no limits, is impossible. Where can an idea come from if anything is possible? Actually, yeah. When you put some constraints on, yes, then the ideas are more likely to come.
No, absolutely. And I sort of learned this from kind of the first time I sort of learned Photoshop. I sort of taught myself Photoshop. So there's a lot of stuff I didn't know how to do, but the few things I could do really well. And suddenly having that kind of, oh, it's a blank piece of paper, but it's a blank piece of paper with a caveat. This is how you can work. This is what you can do, and this is what you can't do. Suddenly it sort of allows you. Yes, if you've got an entire universe of anything, you can go in any direction. It's great in theory, but yes, we all need a kind of direction first. We all need a little bit of structure. We all need, yeah, parameters, I think. So otherwise, yeah, it would just, nothing would make sense, would it?
So what now? There's a couple of things I want to ask you about the future. And the first is, when you've achieved an amount of success and you've got recognition and you're basically living the dream, certainly from an outside perspective, there are people who'll be looking at you and saying, that's what I want to do. I want to write books and I want to make a living from it. I want Tom Hardy to read them on the TV. Is there anything? So I remember seeing a video of, I think it was a TED talk by Elizabeth Gilbert, who said that after Eat, Pray, Love came out and was this massive hit and then was made into a movie, she had this awful, well, what do I do now? You know, I've maybe written the best book I'm ever going to write. And actually that success itself can be intimidating and can shut down your creativity. I just wonder if that's anything at this point that ever comes into your mind.
I mean, it does. You always think that sort of this is the last idea I'll ever get. But I've I've been doing this for about 10 years now, and I'm sort of, how many books have I done? I've probably done about 10 or 12 books, and they range from sort of chapter books, just slightly sort of kind of older primary school kids, to sort of picture books and sort of all in between. So I'm kind of, you know, I'm fairly confident that I know what I'm doing, and I'm fairly good at sort of generating ideas. And I've got sort of like, on my phone is like half ideas, half, which if someone ever stole my phone and read these sentences, they, you know, they were sort of the diary of a maniac, but they sort of, in my head, they make sense to me. So I'm never sort of worried that that will happen, because I know that I've probably got five or six ideas that I'd like to work on. And when I start to work on those, those ideas might lead to other ideas, or half ideas might get turned joined in with other half ideas. I think it's also, I'm very lucky that I'm able to illustrate as well, because it means that I'm not restricted by just thinking about words, just thinking about stories. I can think about pictures as well, and that gives everything another aspect to it. So far it hasn't happened. And sort of inspiration can come from anywhere. It can, it's something you say, or something is said to you, or, you know, something you see. I did, I wrote a book called Up and Away, and it's about a boy who grows a planet. And the sort of, the image that I had was, I was taking my two boys to a restaurant, and they sort of both came out with balloons. And this sort of shows the difference between my two sons. One was hanging onto it, clinging onto it so tightly. The idea of the balloon sort of floating away was really heartbreaking for him. It was really sort of, he couldn't bear the idea this balloon would go away. And my other son was kind of like, I can't wait to let this balloon go away. And I thought, isn't that interesting though, that when you see a balloon sort of floating across the sky, isn't it, does it make them feel happy that it's kind of been liberated, and make them feel sad? And so I had this kind of image chewing around my head. I thought, wouldn't that be interesting if we swapped the balloon? The balloon was a planet instead. So there's a kind of a boy who had a planet on the end of his string. And just sort of looking around, that sort of got turned into an idea that turned into a drawing, because I thought it was a really lovely drawing that then got turned into a book. And it's about, sort of, yeah, it's about a boy who grows a planet sort of using like some rocks and some water and like a sort of cake mixture, ends up growing this planet. This planet gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it's sort of, everything starts getting stuck to it. And he realizes that the balloon sort of the planet belongs up in the stars. So he has to let it go. So there's this beloved thing that he had. Sort of, sometimes you've got to let go of the things you love the most, and it sort of floats off away. So that's where sort of that came from. And that was just, you know, just looking at my two kids and sort of seeing how they behave around balloons and how different they are, but yet sort of, where do I fit into this? And sort of looking back at it and thinking about your own childhood and looking at their childhood. So all these kind of mixed emotions are sort of go into twisting and turning, and eventually turns into a book.
What I'm really hearing as you're talking is that you give yourself time to, for the ideas to come, that you don't put yourself under massive pressure, and kind of get on with your life, and the ideas come from there.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's really, and I've done that a couple of times where I've sort of woken up with something, and this is great, let's send this out, let's do this, and it's not quite right, or there's something missing, and it the ideas don't sort of end up working in the end. So you've got to sort of, you've got to allow them to kind of permeate and sort of turn into something. And quite often it is that sort of, here's a half idea, here's another half idea. Can we link them together? Can they work? Do they make a better idea? Are they sort of bolted together and it's kind of clumsy? Also, you know, it's really important in my industry, sort of working with editors. I never go to an editor with, here's the story, here's the book, here are all the drawings, here we go. It's always a half idea, a three-quarter idea that I take to them, and then we kind of look at and work at together. We sort of shape it together. Finding the right voices who can influence you without it becoming sort of listening to four different they're all taking you and turning you into sort of four different ways.
With that in mind, the ideas and new ideas coming, what's next for you? I know that The Accidental President, which, by the way, when I saw that there was a book, The Accidental President, I thought it was a joke based on The Accidental Prime Minister. I thought, oh, yeah, someone's been clever and they've made a Tom McLaughlin kind of book about Accidental President, but it's your real book.
No, it's my real book. So, yeah, so The Accidental Prime Minister was my first chapter book. This is the book I got fired from my own audio recording, which is the first time, as I say, when I felt like I'm a writer. There was 30,000 words in this rather than the kind of normal 400 or 500 for a picture book. So, it did really well. Then it was kind of, okay, where do we go next? Basically, I got to sort of live all the lives that I don't get to live otherwise. So I got to be Prime Minister for a while, then I got to be a secret agent and the accidental secret agent. There was a billionaire, there was a Father Christmas, all accidentals. And then we took this sort of sidekick character from the accidental Prime Minister and turned him into the accidental president. It seems sort of quite sort of topical to get, you know, we're considering politics at the minute. A kid running America could, you know, couldn't do any worse, certainly. So yes, so that's with Oxford University Press that and we've got another book in the series to do that. There's another book just come out called The Day I Became the Most Wanted Boy in the World. That's with Walker, which is sort of like which is another series about a sort of boy who events escalate and the sort of worst imaginable things. He goes out to the shop to buy some parsnips for his mum and becomes the most wanted criminal in the world. All in a sort of a series of kind of unfortunate events and things like that. So that's just come out. And I've just done a picture book for Bloomsbury called Along Came a Different, which is all about sort of different people and different people getting along with each other and sort of tolerating each other and learn to celebrating sort of the difference of each other and things like that. So I think, these kind of, the news is still influencing me even now sort of with these books.
Well, it's great. I wish you all the success in the world in future. It's been fantastic talking to you, and I'm sure that you inspired some people who, you know, are really struggling with their creative projects to maybe have a little bit less struggle in it.
Yeah. I don't think you don't need to be that sort of tortured artist, you know, just take things down and see what happens and see how things go. But, you know, give yourself the best opportunity by giving yourself the best preparation, I think.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Such great advice from Tom there, and what a lovely chap. I would love to hear from you if you're keen to write or paint or draw or bake or anything that feels like it's not a proper job, or if you have a book in progress, you're trying to make any of those creative pursuits a reality. I'd love to hear from you. Having written a few books myself, I know that it can be a tough process. It's not all fun and games, but the feeling of finishing and having that book in your hand is so incredible, it's worth the pain. You can find out more about Tom at tommclaughlin.co.uk, or you can get any of his books on Amazon. Just go there and search for him. And please stay in touch with us. We're now sending out more regular emails to subscribers of the newsletter with what's new, where I am, what I'm learning, podcast episodes you might have missed, and some new programs that we're launching in the autumn, which is all very hush hush at the moment, but it's very exciting, spending a lot of time putting that together. So it's definitely worth signing up. You'll be the first to know about it if you sign up to that newsletter. So please just go to the website, www.abrilliantgamble.com, and a pop-up will pop up and you could sign up to the newsletter there. But with all the various ways that you can stay in touch with me and the team here at A Brilliant Gamble, here's the lovely Ivy Palmer.
We'd love to to hear from you, you can get all the episodes of this show, plus read the blog and find out more about our travel adventure at www.brilliantgamble.com. Sign up to the newsletter and get an advance notice of the classes and programs Mummy is running. Plus, you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Brilliant Gamble. Finally, please leave a review and star rating for this podcast on iTunes, as it helps people find us and take a brilliant gamble of their own.